This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In news accounts, they often show up as black-clad enigmas. In Western eyes, Muslim women can seem to be obscured by veils and burqas, oppressed by culture and religion. Two new reports by the United Nations and the World Bank blame the Mideast's slow pace of economic and social development in part to the limited roles available to Arab women. And recent news stories from Afghanistan report that many of the freedoms won in the fall of the Taliban have been rolled back. But also this month, an Iranian woman lawyer won the Nobel Peace Prize. Two women were re-elected to Oman's Council of Advisors. And in France, Muslim women continue to battle for the right to wear headscarves in public schools. Throughout the Islamic world, both East and West, reformers are challenging patriarchal ideas from within their religion and societies. For some, that means better access to education and jobs. For others, it's a theological struggle to find a more egalitarian interpretation of the Quran. Later in this program, a look at why we both fear and crave the sensation of falling. But first, Muslim feminism, what the concerns are, where the battles take place, and how this movement differs from Western versions. If you have questions about feminism in the Islamic world, join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And we're going to begin with a conversation with Leila Ahmed, who's a professor of divinity at Harvard's Divinity School. And she's with us from Harvard University. And welcome to Talk with the Nation.
A pleasure to be with you.
How widespread is feminism in the Muslim world? Is that a term that's widely used?
I'm not sure the term is widely used, but the objectives and ideals are widely used. The term isn't because it's seen as very, the term itself is seen as Western. Mm-hmm. So they don't necessarily want to identify with that, but certainly the goals of liberation, equality for women in all matters is a widespread goal throughout the Muslim world, yes.
And is the discussion of this limited to intellectual circles, or is this common?
It's common, but it's I don't really know. I think it's probably, as in America too, the educated middle classes by and large who are arguing it, rather than people whose economic conditions make it very difficult for them to do anything but struggle to live, you know.
Is feminism in the Muslim context, is this seen as something that's derived from Western ideas, or is it seen as something that derives from Islamic thought?
I think it's seen as both. I think the argument now is often being made that it is actually intrinsic to Islam, but the truth is too that the discovery of feminist ideals is profoundly indebted to the Western rise of feminism in the West, and in America in particular. So even if it is arguably to be found within the Muslim world in the original Quran, it's also thanks to Western movements of the 19th and 20th century that it has revived again and become an issue again.
And where is this issue argued out?
I think everywhere. I mean, in every level. And it's been argued out, one should say, for over a century. It began in 1899, the first big debate about whether women should veil or not. And that was the beginning of all kinds of debates about women's education. Women, after all, went to university. In 1929 in Egypt, they were getting education. They were trained in lawyers. The first lawyer graduated in 1932 or something. So it's a long, long movement. It isn't just happening today.
Now, is this the issue of the veil? Is this a symbolic issue, or is this at the crux of this discussion?
I think it's symbolic, but it's. It's at the crux in a way. It's actually really an invention of the West as to why the struggle of the veil, it emerged because of the confrontation between the West and Islam as an issue. But then it has become so complicated throughout history. I mean, you know, it's becoming quite common in America now, and people who the children of parents who are not veiled, who are born American, are taking on the veil. And that isn't, it's a very complicated issue about identity and where we are. So it's not a purely religious issue by any means. It's about the interface of cultures and civilizations.
Yet throughout the Islamic world, and as you mentioned, in this country as well as everywhere else, there is a strong Islamic revival, and women from, according to what I've read, all kinds of classes, all kinds of different groups are universally adopting the hijab.
I think universally puts it a little bit strongly, but it's certainly true that there is a trend. I mean, it's a very interesting to me to go to Egypt when in the 40s and 50s when I grew up, you could scarcely see a hijab or veil in the streets. Now it's commonplace. So it's about the changes of history, and again, very much related to what is happening globally in the politics of our world and why the hijab is becoming a new way of speaking or of identifying as people who are subjects often of Western hatred or Western prejudices. And it's a statement of pride in a way, a bit like, remember the Afros and Black is Beautiful, that kind of movement. It's a way of asserting and claiming identity in a positive way, among other things.
In the West, feminism is generally seen as a secular movement. Is that the case in the Islamic world?
I think it's both. It has been very secular, and it is becoming more religious. But I think they continue to be strands that are both secular and religious. It's happening on all sorts of fronts, just as actually over here.
Mm-hmm. Now, does Islam allow for a more equitable role for women?
Well, now, it depends what we're calling Islam. And let me take it at its simplest level. If we talk about the Quran is, of course, a text, which means it's made of words, which means it can be interpreted. And I think the best analogy would be the American Constitution. If, for instance, there was a moment in which justice in America meant the right to own slaves and the women having no rights except for what their husbands decreed. Mm-hmm. That was the understanding of justice. That's exactly the same with the Quran. The Quran says justice is foundational to society, but each age and each society decides what justice means, and they fight about what does it mean. Does it mean women too or not? Does it mean equality across races or doesn't? Does it mean that Christians and Jews living in Muslim societies have a right to equality or doesn't it? All of these issues have to be fought out over and over.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking with Leila Ahmed, a professor of divinity at Harvard's Divinity School, and the issue is Islamic feminism. And let's take a call from Douglas, who's with us on the line from San Antonio.
Hi,
you're on the air.
I've read some books about Islam, and they mention this early woman leader. I don't know if she was an imam at the time they called it a schism, and I can't remember if she was done away with. But who was that woman, and what was her take on Islam at the time? I don't know her name, but she was one of the earliest imams or something, leaders of a certain part of Islam.
I'm not at all sure who you mean. You might be referring to the Prophet's wife Aisha, who actually led a rebellion in a war against one of the imams.
That's her.
Well, it was his Muhammad's wife. She was a very erudite woman, and a woman. By the fact that she led a battle, that will tell you that, who was used to taking initiative. These kinds of practices actually died out as Islam became established. It tells us something about the early society of Islam, which was far more permissive towards women in leadership than later Muslim societies have been.
Hmm. Well, thank you.
Douglas, thanks for the call. In a little bit more modern times in Egypt, tell us a little bit about a woman who was named Huda Sharawi.
Yes. Well, she, I think she was born in the late 19th century. She became very involved in feminism, partly at the instigation of French and British friends. This was the height of the moment in which the Battle of the Veil was going on. And it's a very interesting moment because it's the time that colonialism, she was Egyptian, the colonial came to Egypt and that was the part of the Arab world that it came to first, British colonialism. And those were the days when there was the governor of Egypt was a man called Cromer, who was promoting the importance of unveiling for women, because he said he wanted women to be modeled after the way that Victorian women lived. Mm-hmm. But we need to bear in mind that this man Cromer was also he was the president of the men's society opposed to women's suffrage. So that in England he took the position of opposing women's rights, and in Egypt he claimed to be supporting women's rights, but what he was really supporting was the spread of British culture, because he thought British way of dressing, not these primitive things of like head veils were primitive and had to be got rid of. So it was really the way, a promotion of British culture rather than in any sense fighting for women's liberation. But in any case, Hoda Sha'arawy was actually a genuine feminist, and taking off the veil and fighting for women's right to be educated became her principal life concerns, and she was quite successful.
The Muslim woman most in the news this month has to be Shirin Ebadi, the Iranian lawyer who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for her efforts at reform. In Iran, the Islamic government places strict constraints on the female population, but it also allows freedoms that many might find surprising. Joining us now from her home in Northridge, California, is Nayara Tohidi, professor of women's studies at the California State University at Northridge and editor of the book Women in Muslim Societies, Diversity with Unity, and it's good of you to join us today.
Yes, hello. Glad to be here.
Nayara, you were out last night celebrating Ms. Ebadi's award with the Iranian community there in Los Angeles. In Iran, the award actually received a mixed reception. To what extent was that influenced by the fact that the recipient was a woman?
Yes, but let me say that we have been celebrating this with American women as well as Iranian women.
Okay.
With Human Rights Watch and the Feminist Majority Foundation. Yes, it has been received with mixed messages. The majority of people, overwhelming majority of Iranians, both inside Iran and outside, are very happy about it. They have been galvanized, they have been energized, they have become more hopeful. But the hardliners, the conservatives, are, of course, and understandably, angry, and they have began writing threatening statements against Shirin Ebadi, calling her part of the infidel tribe and the part of the whole the Nobel Prize to Ebadi, they say, is like rewarding Salman Rushdie, the Zionist regime, and the U.S. leaders, and so forth. And But Shirin Ebadi herself has shrugged off these negative threats, and as is her character, she has been continuing to press on human rights, to demand release of political prisoners, and to also keep as a counter-argument to those who are calling her infidels, they identify herself strongly as a Muslim woman and argue that her Islam and her understanding of Islam is not incompatible with democracy, with human rights, with feminism. She has been actually for years now in Iran representing a reform movement, not only a larger reform movement within society, but especially among women who are trying to articulate a type of feminism which is grounded within the native culture, within the history and even familiar language and discourse of Iranians, while pursuing the same goals that Western feminists have been pursuing, that is, the right to choose, freedom of choice, equal rights, civil rights, democracy. But at the same time, her strategy to reach those goals has been framed within a language which is more accessible and familiar and understandable to the majority of people in Iran.
We're talking about feminist movements in the Islamic world, and we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also email us, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the many ways women in the Muslim world are trying to redefine their roles in society. Our guests are Leila Ahmed, the author of Women and Gender in Islam, and Nayara Tohidi, women's studies professor at Cal State Northridge. Of course, you're invited to join the conversation. If you're curious about issues facing Muslim feminists and Muslim women in general and Muslim women in America, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And why don't we get a caller on the line? Masood joins us from Reno, Nevada.
Hi. I was just trying to point out an experience I had. I grew up in a Muslim society in Iran, and after 25 years when I went back, it was interesting, like a few things I noticed. For example, if you're a woman and you get on a bus, or if you have a kid or a baby, most likely, almost 100% of the time, a man would get up and offer the seat, or maybe sometimes, more than one or two. And overall, I realize that there's actually more respect to a woman as nature, as a human being, not as a sex object, than the Western society here. When you look at, like, a beautiful woman on TV giving news, you look at her as just a human being. It's interesting what you inspire.
Nayira Tohidi, get a response from that?
Well, you can see respect to women in every culture and disrespect and misogyny in every culture. I cannot really generalize that. I cannot really say that Iranians in general are more respectful to women than Americans or vice versa. You find sexist attitudes in America and you find sexist attitudes in Iran. But what is distinct here about when you compare the Western societies like the United States and especially Scandinavian countries in comparison to Middle Eastern countries is that the legal system still is lagging behind the new changes in women's situation in those countries. That is, in the Middle East, most part of the Middle East, and especially in Iran, women's legal rights are embarrassingly deficit. You see, because of the general democracy deficit, you see a very blatant male biasness in the legal system, especially in the family code, and the family law is very obviously discriminatory against women. So agreeing with all that Professor Leila Ahmed said, one of the reasons why we have a growing feminist movement and feminist discourse in Muslim countries is because of this lag, that there has been many changes. The traditional educational gap between men and women has been closing. We actually now in the Middle East have high percentage of literate women in higher education. Women are the number of highly educated women, university educated women, is either equal to men or even surpassing the number of men. In Iran, for example, there are more women who are getting enrolled in universities. So these highly educated, politically conscious women who have become socialized, and especially thanks to the revolution of 1979, many of them have become more politicized and engaged in a social arena and even in interpretation of religion. So this discrepancy between women, this new middle class, highly urbanized and educated women, and this pre-modern feudal tribal laws that is based on tribal and feudal interpretation of Islam, the canon Sharia law, is the discrepancy in this society that creates a lot of tension, and that's why now women are actually taking away the monopoly of interpretation of Islam or construction of religious values from male clerics and are claiming or reclaiming their own faith based on an egalitarian understanding of Islam. Therefore, they are asking for reform in the legal system, for Islamic reformation. Shirin Ebadi, Mehrangiz Kar, and several other prominent women lawyers, especially, who are equipped with the language of law, with Islamic fiqh, that is jurisprudence, have become dangerously knowledgeable for the male clerics who have used religion to maintain patriarchal power over the society.
Masood, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we wanted to thank Naira. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Sure.
Naira Tohidi is a professor of women's studies at the California State University in Northridge, also editor of the book Women in Muslim Societies, Diversity with Unity. We reached her at her home in Northridge, California. And let's get another caller on the line. Now, Mohammed joins us from Minneapolis.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Neil, I have a quick comment, and my comment is the Quran says the females, they have to cover all their bodies, which Quran says also the females, they have to stay their homes. And which I mean is like Quran says, وَقَرْنَ فِي بُيُوتِكُنَّ. I mean, that's Quran, and this ayah also says that, I mean, females, they can study, but they can go to school and they can be educated. But I mean, my point is like females, they have to cover all their bodies. And as we see now, the females in Afghanistan, I mean, totally, you don't have to cover your head, but you have to cover your head.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to cover your hairs or whatever. But I don't mean you have to cover all your eyes on your face or whatever. But I mean, in accordance to Sharia of Islam, says females, they have to cover. They have to cover their heads.
And thank you very much for the call, Mohammed. And Leila Ahmed, that gets to the question: what does the Quran say? Does it prescribe a particular role for women and particular ways to carry it out?
I think I would stand by what I said earlier, that it's really very much a matter of interpretation, how you interpret it. And I'll make a couple of points. One is that For most of history, since the rise of Islam, Muslims have held slaves because they said the Quran said you have to have, it's perfectly fine to have slaves. They have now concluded, partly as a result of the impact of the West, that actually a real Islam should ban slavery, that it should not be a permitted practice. So that is a very good example of how history interpretation changes with history. Now, as to the veil and all this business of covering up, it's not only in our day that this has become a question. If you look across Muslim societies throughout history, there are many places which did not veil. The styles of dress vary tremendously. The form of dress that the caller seemed to be to have in mind was mm-hmm. the kind of thing that is worn in Saudi Arabia or in Afghanistan. Well, those were particular cultures which dressed in that way. So I think I would really stand by that. It's the Quran is open to reinterpretation and must be reinterpreted always.
With us now is Shaheen Sardar Ali. She's chairperson of the National Commission on the Status of Women in Pakistan, a professor of law at the University of Peshawar. She joins us from her home in Warwick, England, where she's a visiting professor at the University of Warwick Law School. And it's good of you to be with us this evening. Hello, Shaheen.
Hello.
Are you there?
I am, certainly.
Good. Thank you very much for being with us. You devoted a lot of work to improve the standard of women under Islamic law. What are the Sharia laws? We've just been talking about it. What are they based on?
Well, I mean, one of the major differences, shall we say, of opinion that I have with the traditional or classical interpretations of what Sharia means is that I do not believe that Sharia is not really equal to divine law. It's principles of Islamic law that are drawn from the divine sources, such as the Quran. And I make that distinction because what people have said over the centuries and what male jurists and male scholars of Islamic law and jurisprudence have achieved is to simply take the religious text, take the divine text and word and interpret it through their eyes and through their experiences. And therefore, I feel that the legal formulations that you find in a number of Muslim jurisdictions are not an accurate and a true reflection of the Islamic spirit of egalitarianism.
Yet if it's not divinely inspired, some people would think it is, and it's certainly acquired over the centuries, it's going to be very difficult to dislodge, let me put it that way.
Well, I think that it shouldn't be impossible, because up until now, I think it was very convenient for the elite, whether it was political elite or economic elite or simply a male elite, to maintain a status quo, to stop or inhibit independent reasoning and logical argumentation and development and evolution of Islamic law. And so by arguing that the gate of Ijtihad was closed forever, which actually, interestingly, coincided with the decline of Muslim political power, it was so convenient to just simply lull people's memories and ideas and thought processes into deep slumber and maintain the status quo, because that was in the favor of those socio-economic political elites. And with more and more women coming out and saying, well, appropriating that right and power of knowledge to interpret and to understand what Islam is all about, I do believe that there is no reversal in this trend that's possible. One might be, you know, one might face obstacles in this direction, as we are doing currently in Pakistan. For example, I'll give you an example. In 1979, the former General ضیاء-الحق, in order to increase his quote-unquote Islamic constituency, he promulgated the Hudud ordinances, supposedly, in the name of Islam. Now, for all these, for these 20, 25 years after that, women like myself, like hundreds of thousands of other women in Pakistan, have argued and challenged the Islamic legitimacy, if you will, of this formulation of the law. The National Commission on the Status of Women, my successor in office, Justice Majda Rizvi, she led that movement where we said these laws must be abolished. There's a huge furor in Pakistan nowadays. It's really come onto the floor of the assembly. Parliament is talking about it. The whole nation is divided on it. But there is no turning back. We will not allow any politicization of our status and the women's identity to be taken for a ride in this manner. And so we argue, as Muslim women, we have got the right to challenge and we have got the right to reinterpret our religion in a manner that will reclaim for us the dignity and honor that that Islam actually meant all along to be there for human beings, whether it was male or female.
Hmm. Neil, I wonder if I could add a comment here.
Please go ahead, Lila.
What I'm concerned is that I think it's perfectly true that women are arguing to reinterpret Islam in their terms, but I think we need to be aware. And I think that's a very important area of struggle, of course. But we do need to be aware that these are very complex societies which have been secular for good many decades. And I think it's troubling to see the terms of the discourse moved completely within Islamic discussion. I think it's, arguing that the interpretation of Islam is vital and critical. But I also think there are other current societies, including secular voices, that really need to be part of this debate too. And we should not be closing it and limiting it to only people who speak in religious terms.
Oh, I would certainly second that, Laila. I would argue that it's not that there should be multiple channels and spaces for women's discourse that should be open. But up until now, the experiences that we've had in the Pakistan women's movement is that the fact that we were talking of a human rights-based women's rights movement where we were trying to open up multiple spaces almost yes. backfired at one level yes. because people were saying, well, you've left the field open to people who are arguing in the name of religion and saying, well, these are Western educated women, these are women who only talk of women's rights coming from the West. And therefore, in order to reclaim almost that position, we had to engage from a religious viewpoint. And also to actually establish the discourse at a level where we are now in a position to open up and use these multiple spaces. So I think you're very right. I mean, I come from the Pakhtun of the Northwest Frontier Province. We were always quite secular. I mean, and Pakhtun code of honor almost really was primary. Yet, if you look at it now, religion seems to have come to center stage, and until and unless we engage with that argument, the problem is that you have more and more people coming onto center stage using religion as a central argument to push women back.
Shaheen Sardar Ali, thanks very much for being with us. She's the author of the book Human Rights and International Law, Equal Before Allah, Unequal Before Man, a professor of law at the University of Peshawar in Pakistan. We reached her in Warwick, England, where she's a visiting professor. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go get another caller with us. And joining us now is Ramin in San Antonio, Texas.
Yes, hello, Neil?
Yes.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a dedicated listener. I've never called before.
Well, thanks.
Interesting subject. I had a comment and a question. One of the maybe scholars can answer that question. The comment had to do with one of the previous callers about respect in the Islamic societies by men towards women.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Iran. I've been here 25 years, and I hear that a lot from particularly men's point of view, that if women are covered up, it's just a show of respect for us towards them. I mean, the way I see it, you can't have a democracy in a society where more than 50% of the population is second-class citizens. And I can only speak about Iran. As far as the laws in Iran, a woman's testimony in court is worth half the man. And inheritance, a woman gets half the man. Basically, they're half citizens. And I just find it interesting that always men make this claim that if we can't look at a woman, then we won't get excited. I mean, that's kind of why they have to cover their hair, because it's sexually exciting for the man. I mean, to me, it just indicates the weakness of the man, not so let's cover him up so we can't look at him so we won't have temptation.
Well, we just have about a minute or so left. Get a response from Leila Ahmed.
Well, I really appreciate his comment. I think he's probably quite right in his observation.
Ramin, just briefly, do you think women should not wear the veil?
Well, when I was growing up in Iran, I left just prior to the revolution. It was not mandatory. It was by choice. Some families, more traditional, they chose to wear the chador or the headscarf,
mm-hmm.
or even the more extreme, and some didn't.
Okay, so it should be choice.
I mean, here, I live in San Antonio, and I see Muslim women, they're wearing a headscarf, and they don't have to wear it, they just choose to do it.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thanks for the show.
And Leila, thank you very much for coming on the program today.
Pleasure to be with you.
Leila Ahmed is a professor at Harvard Divinity School, the author of Women and Gender in Islam, The Historical Roots of a Modern Debate. She was with us from the studios on the Harvard campus. When we come back from a short break, the sensation of falling and why it's such a thrill. If you're among those who taunt gravity from time to time, call and tell us why. 800-989-8255 or send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.